guys, we have major breaking news that just came out here. Now, I'm coming to you, like, within 2 minutes of seeing this. So the details right now are few and far between, but I'll tell you what's floating out there in the ether. It is confirmed that Israel has directly attacked Iran. Now, leading up to this, we all know the chain of events. You had Israel attack the Iranian consulate in Syria. They were trying to kill the person who was General Soleimani's replacement. They succeeded in doing.
Namaste, welcome, and suswagatam, shalom to our today's episode number 231 of Virat Hindustan Sangam on our all social media channels. We have a very important discussion today for the next 1 hour, and the topic is Israel versus Iran, a case of clash of civilization. And for the next 1 hour, Dr. Subramaniam Swamy and our guest, Mr. Joseph Rosen, will be discussing this issue. And I thank our viewers for their viewership for our last program on Ladakh and the China border. And we have got overwhelming response across the globe in 121 countries. So we thank our viewers. Today also we are discussing a very important subject, Israel versus Iran. And we have directly from Jerusalem, Mr. Joseph Rosen. I will introduce you, and then it will be over to Dr. Swamy to initiate the discussion, and then Mr. Rosen will give us an update. Mr. Joseph Rosen, the founder of Solaris Global Partners, is an expert in international relations, geopolitics, Asian affairs, and national security. He previously served in the Israel National Security Council as a foreign policy advisor to 2 Israeli prime ministers and 6 national security advisors, managing the APAC and Euro-Asia portfolios. As a government official, Rosen led the interministerial work on the establishment of a national foreign investment screening mechanism, authored Israel's China policy, and advanced Israel's bilateral relations with Asia. Under the umbrella of Solaris Global Partners, Rosen is focusing on geopolitics and geostrategy, equipping entities of public and private sectors with a compass to navigate the rocky waters of geopolitics, minimize risk, and make well-informed decisions. In addition, Solaris Global Partners works to establish fundamental and foundational partnership of mutual benefit between investors, entrepreneurs, and startups. So we have a geopolitical expert directly joining us from Jerusalem, and we welcome him to our show. And it is over to Dr. Swamy to initiate today's topic, and then we will hear from Mr. Joseph Rosen. Over to Dr. Swamy.
Thank you, Jagdish. We are all excited by today's scholar visitor program. In India, in fact, we are very interested in the subject of Israel versus Iran, because the Iranians, being not Sunnis but the other category of religion in of Islam, have been in India. Sunnis are little hardliners. They came from as invaders and so on. But the Shias are very well regarded in India. and therefore it automatically became that with Iran we have good relations. I myself have visited Iran in 2006, and the Iranians invited me. I said, you know that I've been a very long-term supporter of Israel, and still you are inviting me. Then they said yes, because you can have the deal with Israel directly. We have no problem, and they should have no problem about you dealing with us. But over the years, when these clerics got worse and worse in Iran, things these become a bit rigid. When I was teaching at Harvard, I had Iranian students, I had Israeli students. They were probably the most brightest among the foreign students that came to Harvard. So, you know, this whole civilization of the two is such that, if Iran had not taken this drastic step, I think Israel and Iran having not necessarily friendship, but certainly a cordial relationship would have been good for the world. But it's not happened, and Iran has done something which they should have known, that the retaliation would be tremendous if the Israelis want to do so. So in this context, I would state that the Jews have suffered a tremendous amount over centuries. And it's only in 1948 they were able to get back a portion of the land which was belonged to them. And it was all rock, there was no way of thinking of cultivation there, of agriculture. But in no time they transformed it. They devised new methods of irrigation, the drip irrigation, which is now famous all over the world and is also used in India. So the Israelis have come up, and then their brains and their capacity to innovate and invent that enabled Israel to become a fierce country, in terms of that if you mess with them, you are going to get messed up. So in that context, we are admirers in India, and the Hindu community particularly is being extremely fond of in the length and breadth of India or Israel. Whenever I go anywhere in India to address meetings, I've been constantly asked about Israel, and how can we duplicate what they do to their neighbors if they misbehave. So the Israeli respect has been enormous. We had Jews in our country also who came as refugees and settled down here. They became, some of them became military generals. In fact, India's war to break Pakistan into two would not have taken place but for General Jacob, who was, of course, later on decorated. He led the battle in what is now known as Bangladesh. And he personally swam across the huge river, which is one of the branches of Ganga, and reached the other side to be able to go and get the Pakistani commander-in-chief for Bangladesh, in those days called East Pakistan, arrest him, and then make 100,000 soldiers lay down their arms. And they were all taken to an Indian prison in Delhi and kept there. And, then it was General Jacob. And why I'm saying specially what General Jacob is, a message had gone from Mrs. Gandhi through Manik Shah, who was our commander-in-chief, to General Jacob, not to proceed and take Dhaka. And the reason was that the Soviet Union and America both, the Americans were with the Pakistanis. Henry Kissinger was a premier in advocating that. And so the Soviet Union, then Soviet Union, and the United States put pressure on Mrs. Gandhi, don't proceed any further. The Pakistan is going to surrender and leave it at that. But to create a new country called Bangladesh, the credit goes to General Jacob. who disregarded the direction from the commander-in-chief and took the whatever size of the army he had and went across. In fact, as I told you, he swam across and then made General Niazi, who was the Pakistani commander and head of the government of that time, the East Pakistan, and that the surrender took place. General Jacob was then court-martialed, but he said that I never received any information because there was no electricity, so therefore the teleprinter was not working. So otherwise I would have obeyed the orders, but since the teleprinter was not working, I went ahead with the earlier orders. So we have had like that. We have had Jews on many other fields in our country, and of course all of them happily went back when Israel was created. But one thing that the Israeli parliament recorded, that the only country they can think of where the Jews were not persecuted, were treated well, and they lived a normal life, they said, is India. So India has this historic background, and therefore we have been friendly. So it is in this context that I will hand over the so-called microphone to our friend who is now speaking to us from Jerusalem, and Mr. Poland, and he will tell us exactly how the circumstances under which Israel was compelled to bombard Iran. And I would say, if there's any Indian friendship left in Iran with most of the Indians in India, then the Iranians should understand that we want both of them, both Iran and Israel, to live in peace. Iran is a Shia country. Their history with Sunnis has been terrible. I'm not saying that they will have the same thing. After all, the Saudi Arabian leader number two is called MBS. He's a very forward-looking person. Maybe the Saudi Arabians could also join. But at the moment, we want to know where this war is heading. Is it going to lead to a clash of civilizations and a World War III, or it is going to be limited to what it is today? Over to Joseph. Best wishes to you for coming on our program, and thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Namaste. Thank you very much for having me. It's a great honor, and I really appreciate you giving me this stage. By the way, the title of this episode is very symbolic, because you called it the conflict or war between civilizations, and actually tomorrow the Jewish people will celebrate the holiday of Passover, commemorating the exodus from Egypt and relive the journey from slavery to liberation. By tradition, every Jewish person is obligated to see themselves as though they came out from Egypt. In that sense, for many generations, the Jewish people have faced various enemies throughout history and always prevailed. And this story, this Jewish tradition, is very relevant to nowadays, very relevant to the current geopolitical environment, not only in West Asia, but globally as well. Specifically regarding West Asia and Israel's strategic concerns, as you well know, Israel faced a near existential threat on the 7th of October and has been fighting a multi-front war since then. In Gaza, Israel has been fighting the Hamas terror organization with the effort of achieving two goals. One, to release the Israeli hostages. Second, dismantling Hamas from its military capabilities and governing power over Gaza. In the northern arena, we face Hezbollah, which launched rockets again since the 7th of October, actually leading to a massive evacuation of the Israeli population from the north. And still no estimated date of their return of our civilians to return to their homes in the north. And in addition, also the attacks by the Houthis from Yemen directed at Israel, but also disrupting international maritime trade. And we have to remember that the facilitator of all these attacks was Iran, in fact. Iran provided arms, funding, training, and basically the infrastructure for its proxies to attack, actually to serve two goals. One, to attack Israel, because their main goal is the destruction of Israel and the Jewish people. And the second goal is to secure their dominance of the Muslim world as a first step in West Asia, but they have also global aspirations. So until the direct attack, the direct Iranian attack against Israel, the preferred method of action of the Iranian regime was to use its proxies, as I mentioned before, the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah. For that was the main method for at least two decades. That changed following the direct Iranian attack against Israel. There was some international or figures within the international community who believed that there is some weight for diplomacy and diplomacy can work in dealing with Iran. But eventually, after the Iranian direct attack against Israel, many within the international community now understand that Iran is part of the problem and not part of the solution, and diplomacy is not the way to deal with such a threat. And now, following the direct attack, Iran is basically in the front and is exposed to any direct attack by, potentially, of course, by Israel and its partners. So let's just briefly list again the chain of events that led to the current geopolitical environment. So it started, this change of development started in the 1st of April, when Israel allegedly killed an Iranian general in a facility next to the Iranian consulate in Damascus. According to the reports, Israel did not attack the Iranian embassy or the consulate, but a military facility next to it. As a result, one brigadier general, Mohammed Zadi, was killed together with several more officials from the IRGC. And that led the Iranians to promise and retaliate against against Israel. Now we have to remember that that brigadier general and the other officials of the IRGC were their activity in Syria and Lebanon was mainly in setting up the infrastructure and providing arms supplies to Iran's proxies in Lebanon and Syria, mainly Shia militias and Hezbollah in Lebanon. So it was not like Israel attacked so-called peaceful advisors, allegedly, of course, according to media reports. It was targeting terrorists and terrorists who worked on behalf of the Iranian regime. Now, as I said before, Iran promised to retaliate, and as the use also before, they made everyone guessing about the scope and the timing of the attack against Israel, leaving the international community, and I must say also Israel, also Israel on edge. And I had several talks with my friends living in the north part or northern part of Israel. Some of them were really in fear of the Iranian attack. But that was part of the mind games that the Iranians played heading to their retaliation. So finally, on the 14th of April, the night between Saturday to Sunday, Iran launched a massive attack. It included, if I remember correctly, 170 drones, about 30 cruise missiles, more than 100 ballistic missiles. But in the end, even this very massive attack, one of the biggest ever, only 9 missiles breached the defense umbrella of Israel and hit an airbase in the south part of Israel, causing only minor damage to some infrastructure in probably one plane or two. And following the attack, there was no other option for Israel but to retaliate. And so it did. And using the same method of the Iranians, now it was Israel's turn to play mind games with the Iranians, with the Iranian regime, because Israel doesn't see the Iranian people, the Iranian civilization, as an enemy. Everything is targeted against the Iranian regime, which is a terrorist regime. So this time, Iran was on the edge and guessing. It returned some of its so-called advisors from Syria back to Iran. Its leader, Khamenei, declared publicly that Israel should not retaliate, and he even expressed his willing to end this round of violence, basically pressuring Israel to stand down in a step that actually expressed some fears within the Iranian regime. And in these circumstances, Israel finally executed its response to the missile attacks against it when on the 18th of April, Israel, unlike Iran, executed a very, based on media coverage and foreign reports, executed a precise attack against a very strategic facility, or at least strategic location in Iran. And by doing so, it exposed the weakness of the Iranian intelligence, who did not foresee the attack and could not prevent it. It also exposed the weakness of the defense, the missile defense systems provided mainly by its ally Russia. And on the same equation, in the context of technology and defense, it really showed the huge gap or difference between the Israeli superiority, both defensive and offensive, and to the weakness of the Iranian regime. And this chain of events, the killing of the Iranian general in Syria, the Iranian retaliation, and then the Israeli precise attack, can teach us in West Asia, but not only, also the international community and specifically the Indo-Pacific region, several lessons. So if I may, I can go through the lessons or the main insights that I wrote to myself. I would be happy to share with you. Or if you prefer, Dr. Swami, we can leave it to the part of the to the questions and the discussions, because some of the lessons, as I said, are very relevant to the Indo-Pacific region. In a nutshell, I would say that this chain of events crystallized the challenge of middle powers or middle countries to shape their relations with a superpower like the US in a way that secures an umbrella, defensive umbrella, from any potential threat or challenge, while maintaining operational freedom to act in lines that the superpower is not willing to act, mainly in offensive and even preemptive attacks.
Good. Yes, I think questions will be there. Jagdish, I think let our team ask some questions, and then towards the end, I will also intervene with some questions.
Arvind or Ramesh, you can start.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Joseph. Shalom. I have only one question for you. Why is it that the world always expects Israel to show restraint, be it the Hamas, be it Iran, be it any other country? The first thing they come out, Israel should show restraint. Why is that? Why? Where is this concept coming from? Why is it always that Israel should always show restraint? And why not the aggressor, in this case, Iran, be it Hamas? They're always the aggressors. Israel has never been an aggressor in going to war. And why is it always Israel should show restraint?
Well, for me, it's very, very difficult to analyze the psychology behind the views of European countries and the US. But I would say that the responsibility of Israel and the Israeli government is to project power. And as long as Israel projects power, mainly in the region, that will lead also to its partners, mainly the US, but also European partners, to respect its national security interests and respect the Israeli need to maintain this freedom of operation and protect itself by itself. Of course, by relying to some extent on the American or the regional coalition defensive umbrella. So I don't want to analyze what's going on in the minds of others. But speaking of Israel, there is a responsibility for us to project power. And this is something that was damaged on the 7th of October And one of the results or the achievements in fighting Hamas in Gaza and other proxies of Iran, including the direct retaliation against Iran, one of the goals is restoring that image of middle power, of Israel being a middle power technologically, restoring the image of intelligence power. All those dimensions that were really hurt during the Hamas attacks on the 7th of October.
Thank you. One last question. Is a two-state solution possible at all?
I think
based on your interactions, you've spoken to so many people, so many leaders all across, and all the experts. What do you think about this solution? Is it possible at all?
So I would say this. I think that the two-state solution in the lines that many other countries and figures we're talking about in the last several decades is irrelevant after the 7th of October. I would add to that that there has to be some kind of a discussion regarding the political future of the Palestinian entity. I'm not willing to enter the specific definitions, but there must be some kind of a discussion about it. And I truly believe that realizing regional programs that produce prosperity and peace, like IMEC, which is led by India, US, and some European countries, and is very crucial for the Middle East and Israel as well, could lead also the Palestinians to compromise on some political issues that until now prevented them from resolving the political question regarding their status as a political entity. So I'm not sure about the specific definition, whether a state, some kind of autonomy, but first of all, we need to find the ways in order to encourage the Palestinians to be part of a peaceful architecture in the region and not continue with their obsession of destroying Israel. And there is no... When you focus on the ideology, there is no much difference between Hamas and other sections of the Palestinian society. In the end, the main difference is the tactics. But I believe there is a chance for some people who identify themselves as Palestinian to find more gains in incorporating in such frameworks like IMEC. And myself, I had several interactions with people who identify themselves as Palestinians, but at the same time, they were very, in a sense, they were even a bit Zionist, in the sense that they acknowledged the right of Israel to have their country in the land of Israel, which is very, very rare, unusual for Palestinians to admit. So with at least based on the on this interaction I had with very unique and special Palestinian people, there is a positive future between us. But anyway, we'll have to leave the political definitions for later and try to build the relations bottom up.
And I had a question to you.
Sure.
You know, Israel has good relations with your neighboring country,
Jordan
has perhaps 55% of his population are Palestinians. And yet the country with 55% of population are Palestinians, you have no problem with Jordan. Jordan, in fact, is on your side. At least it's on the side of the Americans and so on. I don't see any conflict. The Egyptians were in the 1967, you swallowed up in the battle with Moshe Dayan the entire area between Israel and Egypt. Then you returned it all back to Egypt. So what the question I'm asking you is, that is this this Palestinian, this Hamas in particular, which has originally had come through an election and then never allowed another election to take place, are they motivated by any of these powers like China or Russia that they are emboldened to do these things that they have done in the recent past?
Well, both Egypt and Jordan, they have some projects and interests vis-a-vis Russia and China. But I think the main motivation of our neighboring countries following the war in Gaza is that behind closed doors, Egypt and Jordan are breaking Israel, because in the end, you also see it, Egypt was fortifying its wall on the Rafah border to prevent any Palestinian refugees to move from the Gaza Strip to Egypt. They don't want them there. Same goes also for Jordan. As you mentioned, there is a very there's a large Palestinian population in Jordan. It's one of the national security concerns of Jordan. To emphasize the severity of this national security concern, since the 7th of October, Iran was increasing its efforts to meddle with in the internal arena in Jordan, using different sections of the Palestinian population in order to set up some kind of an infrastructure or terrorist groups to attack Israel from Jordan. And it was another example in which Iranian efforts to attack Israel actually led to the opposite result. Jordan was increasing its cooperation with Israel in sharing intelligence and coordinating operations to stop the Iranians, not only, as I said, as I just mentioned, in relation to those Palestinian groups in Jordan, but also in preventing the Iranian the direct Iranian attack against against Israel. And I am sure that before the precise attack of Israel in on Iranian soil, there was also some level of coordination with Jordan and other Arab countries. One signal or example for this was the fact that, according to various reports, Israel launched the missile, whether it was a drone or aircraft. It launched it from outside the Jordanian airspace because they didn't want to get the Jordanians be a potential target for Iran and keep it as a direct conflict between Iran and Israel. So I think there's much consideration between Israel and its neighboring countries and other Arab countries. And it's a very positive development, considering that one of the main motives behind the Iranian, the Hamas attack on the 7th of October was to halt and to stop the normalization process with Israel, the shaping, the design of a new peaceful architecture in the region, in West Asia. And now we see, at least on the security sphere, that that Israel can coordinate, cooperate together with Arab countries. So at least on the security sphere, we can see in our own eyes how this new architecture in West Asia takes shape and realizes. I hope personally that it will lead also to the realization of IMEC, because in the end, even a broad and visionary plan program like IMEC is not very effective without a very significant role of Israel serving as a bridge between Asia and the Middle East and Europe, and mainly the Mediterranean area, which is closer in mentality to the Middle East and so on.
Ramesh?
Yes, sir, that's fine. Arvind, you can proceed.
Thank you. Yes, thank you, Mr. Joseph, for providing Israel's perspective on this conflict between Israel and Iran. You know, India is friendly to Israel for a long time, and so with the Iran. And naturally, it is India is concerned. Now, in any such conflict, the superpower United States also has a role to play. Now, my question to you is, how do you perceive whether this is going to escalate? And if it is going to escalate, I mean, like when the conflict between Russia and Ukraine started, we thought it will last for a week, 10 days, 15 days, and finish. And has been going on for months together. And similarly, the Hamas attack on Israel and then Israel's retaliation also has been there for a long time. Now, so if it is going to escalate, now what will be the role of Islamic countries? Dr. Swami mentioned about the Jordan. Of course, Jordan is close to Israel and friendly. What is going to be the role of the Muslim countries, Islamic countries in this conflict? And how United States is going to play a role, given the equations, geopolitical equation, Israel has been friendly with the United States, and on all time, United States has been standing with Israel in all the conflicts so far. So whether United States will also play a role, and if it does, then will it turn into a world war?
Thank you.
Okay, so I try to answer all of your questions. Regarding the chance for escalation, on the immediate time frame, I'm not sure that we will witness any escalation, but it is still too early to say if the Israeli retaliation is part of of a broader strategy and only one step of many, first step of many, in maybe a new paradigm to deal with Iran, mainly not attacking the or dealing with its proxies, but step by step, exhausting Iran and attacking Iran also directly also in the future. So it's too soon to see if the Israeli retaliation is part of a broader strategy or was just a needed retaliation in order to return to the immediate concerns, which are dealing with Hezbollah on the northern arena and continue the war with against Hamas. And one of the achievements of this chain of events with Iran is that, according to some reports, the Americans are now willing to let the Israelis, to let Israel to continue with its operation in Gaza, mainly in Rafah. Which is a very strategic point in the war against Hamas. And so far, Israel was not executing force there because of American pressure. So it's one of the achievements of the Iranian attack, allowing us to expand our war against Hamas. Another signal for me assessing that a potential escalation now is not very realistic is the fact that traditionally the position of Prime Minister Netanyahu was mainly defensive. Traditionally, he was trying to abstain from any broader conflict, and even in the context of Hamas, it was believed that this terror organization could be bought and keep in peace by some gestures. So my main fear is that the main security conception within the Israeli defense apparatus, the security apparatus, didn't really change since the 7th of October, and is still dominated by still very defense oriented. It is also reflected by the statements and the joy expressed after the really great achievement of dealing with the Iranian attack, in which only 9 out of more than 300 drones and missiles launched at Israel, only 9 were eventually hit Israel. So the joy over this defensive achievement, to me, it's a bit worrisome because it signals that not much has changed since the 7th of October. Another achievement that I can point out is the again, thanks to Iran, the U.S. House of Representatives finally approved the defense, again, defense aid bill, providing defense aid to Israel, together with Ukraine and the Indo-Pacific, mainly to Taiwan. And again, in my view, the recent developments are some kind of a wake-up call for the Israeli government to find the ways to reshape its very its special relations with the U.S. based on the understanding and the assumption that the defensive umbrella, the American umbrella, is much needed, and you cannot fight without it. But at the same time, as a partner and not as a country who is which is relied or dependent on the superpower, but a partner, you need to still have the freedom of operation. And this lesson is very, very much relevant to Japan as well. Only last week, we saw the historic summit between Prime Minister Kishida and President Biden, even deepening their security relations. One of the aspects of their security relations is also amending the command and control unit stationed in Tokyo in a way that would grant the Americans more mandate to control the operations in South China Sea and East China Sea. And according to some Japanese officials, the framework and the guidelines are still in the making. So looking at the case of Israel and Iran, I would recommend Japan. Again, it's very important to develop together with the Americans the needed defensive capabilities, but make sure that you are still in the status of a partner and not some kind of a satellite country or a partner that is very much dependent on the U.S. and still maintains this freedom of operation. By the way, it aligns with the new security policy published by Japan. One of the new principles in Japan's new security strategy was to develop the needed capabilities for preemptive attack. So in order to execute such preemptive attack, you need to make sure that your ally, the superpower that supports you, will not limit you because it contradicts its interests vis-a-vis China. Because I'm sure that even now, in current days, the U.S. and China are investing a lot of efforts in order to create a dialogue and not and resolve their the competition between them. So I don't see in any situation American boots on the ground or even any potential scenario in which the Americans will launch an attack against China. So in the end, it will be the responsibility and on the shoulders of Japan, and in the end also on the shoulders of India, to deal with the challenges in the Indo-Pacific. So learning from the lessons of Israel-Iran conflict, this is the time to reshape the special and value-based partnership, not just relations, but partnerships with the U.S.
Mr. Joseph, I have three small questions, but if at any stage you feel you don't have to answer, you may say so. But I know because you are no more in the government, but I want to know, does Israel has information about the nuclear development of nuclear capabilities of Iran?
Well, regarding the nuclear, the specific status of the Iranian nuclear program, as far as I know, and I'm not sure that any Israeli official knows, not really, but the fact, what one of the things that the Iranian that the Iranian attack against Israel emphasized, and its will to contain the retaliation to something very very local and prevent a full-scale war, to me is a sign that the military nuclear program is still very high on the Iranian agenda, and the Iranian regime doesn't want anything else to disturb with its intentions to develop a nuclear weapon. Otherwise, probably they would be willing to enter a full-scale war. They would use Hezbollah, its proxy in Lebanon, also in full force. So far, they did not do it. So I believe that they're still in the process of developing nuclear weapons. But my personal view is the imminent threat is not necessarily from the actual nuclear weapon in the hands of Iran. But first of all, it might ignite a regional arms race, nuclear arms race. Second, if nowadays, without a nuclear weapon, the Iranians are confident enough to launch such a massive missile attack against Israel, just try and imagine what they would do with while having a nuclear weapon. They don't even have to use the nuclear weapon. They could just use it as some kind of an insurance policy and use all their conventional weapons arsenal against Israel and other valuable targets.
My next related question, no, I had three questions, Ramesh. Next question is, the American elections are around the corner, which is in November. So will the present president continuing or a new president taking over will have any impact on this whole Israel, Iran, or in your neighborhood? What will be the impact whether the present president continues or new president takes office, will it have any impact on these ongoing activities or the war?
Well, as we're saying, since the 7th of October, the fact that the U.S. is in an election year is really affecting their policy vis-a-vis the Israeli war against Hamas. On the one hand, they support Israel, providing arms and political support in the international arena. But it comes with a price and the pressure on mainly on humanitarian aspects. Another angle to the American position, and I would say also the international position, is some kind of a false differentiation between their position on Israel's war against Hamas and their position against our retaliation against Iran. And to me, it's very weird because must be an understanding that both are part of the same battle against radical axes and part of a global war. It's not just a regional war, not only against Hamas, not only against Iran. So we've already seen what are the main limitations or boundaries of the American policy since the 7th of October. And we're going to see the same with any Democratic administration also after the elections. And with a possible Republican administration directed by Trump, I can't really say because Trump is very you can't really foresee what Trump has under his sleeve. He's full of surprises, but at least if you examine the official statements during his campaign, it was not very far from the same voices we heard from Biden's administration. So I think overall, whether it's the Democratic or the Republican administration, it will be more of the same. And it has also some positive aspect in the sense that there is a chance that Israel might be a bipartisan issue as it used to be and gain bipartisan support from the Democrats and the Republicans together. On the Democratic camp, there are some signs to worry for, mainly because of progressive sections, as we've seen in anti-Israeli and even anti-Semitic protests in campuses of leading universities in the U.S. To a large extent reflect views of those progressive sections within the Democratic Party. And it is a challenge for Israel, the Israeli government, to find the most effective way to convince those progressive audience to support Israel.
My final question, sorry I've been taking time, but is will what will be the impact, by the way, you Israel in that neighborhood is the only genuine democratic country in that neighborhood. And we have been seeing many elections, one after the other. They were not clear-cut majorities, or there used to be coalition and all that. What could have changed or will have impact the 7th October till now, or as it goes on your local politics, on your local government formation and the thinking in your within Israel? That is my last question on this issue.
So one of the most important things following the 7th of October is the understanding within the Israeli society that in order to win and prevail, we as a society, we must be united. One of the reasons or the circumstances that generated the opportunity for our enemies to attack Israel on the 7th of October was their understanding that Israel is weak because the Israeli society was dealing with internal conflicts between secular religious, between right wing and left wing, and it even affected some parts of the IDF, and in a way even the Israeli readiness to deal with potential threats. So following the 7th of October, there is an understanding across the board that we have to be united against our enemies. It's not a question of your political views, but it's a question of how to rebuild our nation, our society, in a way that accepts different opinions, views, voices, and a political system that can reflect these developments within the Israeli society. My personal view, there are some groups in Israel that are now calling for immediate elections in order to choose a new government in Israel, mainly to get rid of Prime Minister Netanyahu, because they see him as the person responsible for the 7th of October, for the whole failures, for the conception that led to the 7th of October. My personal view is that elections at this point would do more harm than good. I don't support any political party. In the last elections, I didn't even vote. What I believe is necessary is not talking about elections, but find ways to build an alternative system of technocrats in order to allow the political system in Israel to heal itself, at least for a year and a half, 2 years, and supply the political system with new blood. Because even if you have elections, in the end, the Israeli public can choose between the same contenders that were there even in the previous elections, previous rounds. So politicians from the left, they were not able to gain much support from the Israeli public. The right, some of the right wing parties, are not perceived as parties that reflect the entire spectrum of views within the Israeli society. So my fantasy is that there will be some kind of unity government that will decide on a technocrat transition government to allow the political system in Israel to heal itself and inject new blood into the system, even to reduce the percentage for the parties to enter the political system. I think it will do good.
Thank you. Sorry, I took off.
Dr. Kori, you go ahead.
Just one short question. You diplomatically pulled off a coup when you got full diplomatic relations with the UAE. I'm wondering whether the same thing is going to happen with Saudi Arabia. Are you going to have diplomatic relations with Saudi Arabia, or is that a much tougher thing for Israel to do?
Well, it was on the table before the 7th of October. After the 7th of October, we all thought that there's no chance to advance any normalization with Saudi Arabia. But thanks to Iran, it's on the table again. because we share the same interests. And as I said before, hopefully the coordination and cooperation that we demonstrated in the security domain, we could also make it happen on the economical sphere, technological, etc. And one of the ways is to realize IMEC. Another positive sign of the positive diplomatic future of Israel is the new government in Indonesia. The newly elected president, Subianto, was one of the only official people who in past years openly met with Israeli officials in international events. He's very pragmatic, and even today, based on Indonesia's efforts to become a member of the OECD organization, it is willing to advance several steps in the direction of normalization with Israel. So we are saying that despite the 7th of October, in the end, all pragmatic countries, Muslim countries, the Sunni countries, and Asian countries, which are not having diplomatic relations with Israel, are all willing to do so because they understand the broader picture and the strategic and the geopolitical interests beyond the mere Palestinian issue.
Thank you. Arvind, yes.
One last question. India has always been following a middle of the road. Most of the times when it's a UN resolution against Israel or something like that, it's always abstained from voting not completely supporting Israel in most of the cases. What is the perception about India, A, in the political circles and in general among the public from Israel?
So in general, the Israeli public is very fond of India. And an interesting thing is, according to several polls, you see a similar or opposite trend. While the popularity of China and Israel is decreasing, the popularity of India in Israel is increasing. It's like it looks like an X. So the in India is becoming more and more popular within the Israeli public, and I agree. In India, traditionally, demonstrates a very balanced approach, very careful and balanced approach. Even following the 7th of October, Modi's government did expressed condolences and support of Israel's right of self-defense, which was very much appreciated within the Israeli public and the Israeli government. At the same time, India sent humanitarian aid to the Palestinians. It is still supporting the two-state solution. It was one of the, unlike many Western countries, including Japan, it did not freeze the funding for UNRWA. And following the Iranian attack against Israel, there was no clear condemnation against of Iran, which to some extent I can understand, because currently India is dealing or negotiating over the release of the 17, now 16 Indian citizens who were on the ship held by Iran. So even in this case, I can understand the position of India, and in from a pragmatic position, I believe, especially following my visit in India 2 months ago, also India sees Israel still as a very important partner and also instrumental in realizing IMEC. I understand that following the geopolitical developments, Israel is now more on the sidelines and India is not very open about advancing concrete projects or cooperation with Israel under the framework of IMEC. That was, in my view, the main reason for Prime Minister Modi to invite Prime Minister Matsoukatis of Greece to the Raisina dialogue instead of someone else from, I don't know, UAE, Saudi Arabia, or even Israel. But hopefully, as Israel can move ahead with some concrete steps with Saudi Arabia, UAE, other countries, I think it will also encourage India to be more open, even under the current circumstances, about the partnership with Israel.
Thank you. Arvindji, you can conclude.
Yeah, we are already running out of time, but Just before I wind up, I have one question to Dr. Swami. Dr. Swami, Indo-Israel trade is four times that of Indo-Iran trade in terms of, I think there's about $11 billion Indo-Israel trade and about $3 billion, maybe less than three Indo-Iran. Do you think this economic size of the relationship will matter in taking a decision for India to take which stance in case the conflict escalates?
The Indian position, as our guest President has very skillfully presented, to see the between the lines, India is fundamentally in favor of Israel, but it doesn't want to be expressive about it. Even if the fact is there that they that the Iranians' trade is much less, India will not like to take a stand which would lead to a break in the relationship, because Iran is very close to us in geographical terms. And all said and done, they are Shias. As far as that side is concerned, they are, you know, they are. And also, you must understand, inside Iran, there is a movement for democracy, very serious movement for democracy. So we should remain clued with the Iranians. But when the chips are down, we are with Israel. That's the view of the general public in the country. And we know that even when we didn't have relations with Israel, they, in their fight against Pakistan, fight against China, all these, the Israelis provided us with a lot of equipment, which we couldn't get from elsewhere. So therefore, I think the Israelis understand when we balance it, and he has very clearly brought it out in very sophisticated language, but I've understood what he said.
Thank you. Thank you. And Ramesh has already said that India has traditionally been taking a neutral position in such conflicts. I'm not still calling it war, because, you know, I'm trying to avoid the term war. So I'm just saying conflict. Yes. Thank you very much, Mr. Joseph Rosen, for having spared more for our program and providing the Israel perspective to us and the inside information which you could share with us. And thanks, Dr. Swami, for initiating the discussion on Israel. And we all know nobody is better friendly than Israel in India than you. And when the diplomatic relations started, the first visa for Israel was issued from your residence. So we all know about this, and Israel also knows about it. This discussion is very much needed, because Indians are looking forward to peace everywhere. And at least in times when there's already conflict in other parts of the world, new conflict should not develop. And therefore, it is important from a peace point of view. Let's give peace a chance. Thank you, Mr. Joseph. Thanks, Dr. Swami, Jagdish and Ramesh for anchoring this program. And no lesser thanks to our technical team led by Asish Shetty, Swaminathan, Tejas Naval Gul, Gadgi Rakesh Ishwar Iyer, Vishal Mehta, Ajesh Nair, and Gurdat Shetty, without whose support this program would not have been possible. Thank you very much. Like this, we'll be meeting every Sunday. We are meeting every Sunday. Next Sunday, again, we'll meet at 8 o'clock Indian Standard Time with a new topic and Dr. Subramanian Swami. Till then, viewers, namaskar, Jai Hind.
Jai Hind.
Jai Hind, Toda.